You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, this is The Brian Callen Show with my colleague, Hunter Motz. Mm. This is Conversations with Brian the Kid Callen. And Hunter Motz has once again gotten our guest, Ryan Holiday, who wrote The Obstacle is Away and best-selling author of Trust Me, I'm Lying. You son of a bitch. Yeah. You were the media relations director of American Apparel, which is a great company. I actually own many of their shirts.
You do.
I like the way they fall on my body. Yeah. And obviously, you've seen what I'm working with, so you're pretty impressed with mine.
Not many of their shares, many of their shirts.
But their shirts. And
I have a 0% ownership stake.
Exactly. Well, I'm sure watching a guy like Dove, what's his last name, who owns?
Dove Cherney,
who owns American Apparel and basically is the man there who does all the stuff. You know, I appreciate a guy like that. I don't know him, but I appreciate anybody who creates. What people don't realize is a guy like that who has 12,000 employees and does all his own photography, he created a lot of jobs. He created those jobs. So he had an idea, and he did something different, and he said, I'm going to make clothing in Los Angeles. I've been to the factory. That's what makes an economy go round. And it's up to a state like California, which they don't do, to make it a hospitable place to set your business up. I'm sure he's gone through a lot of crap with that. But did you write this book, The Obstacle is the Way? Did watching someone like that run a huge company play a factor into this?
Yeah, totally. And it's interesting. If you think about American Apparel, it's a totally insane idea, right? It's like, okay, we're going to make clothes in the U.S. We're going to pay people $13 to $18 an hour to make it instead of like sweatshop wages. And then we're going to control all our own stores, and we're not going to put our logo on any of the clothes.
Amazing.
Right.
But somehow it works. I love that. Actually, I never even thought of that. That's what I like about it. I can't stand when I buy something and they got an advertisement on it.
Yeah. And so it's a totally crazy idea, and then he sort of pushed through it, and then somehow it works.
Hmm. And the book is full of examples of this. I mean,
totally.
Full of examples that are a lot of fun, including MMA stuff.
Yeah, well, what I wanted to do instead of just sort of talking to people about how this works, I'm not in the book at all for this reason, but I wanted to sort of illustrate it with stories that you can't really argue with. You can't say that this person didn't do X and that they didn't face some obstacle and then what they did about it didn't work. Like, mm-hmm. I wanted to sort of be objective and inarguable and ideally, you know, timeless.
Well, yeah. And I think that's the thing. I mean, you know, what I really appreciated is that it's inspired in large part by Marcus Aurelius' Meditations, right?
Right.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about Marcus Aurelius, the good emperor from Gladiator?
Yeah, right. which is most people's familiarity with him, which I totally understand. And super weird movie. His son actually was one of the worst people ever and was killed by a gladiator in real life.
Wow.
Everything else in the movie is not true, but that part's super awesome. But anyways, so Marcus Aurelius, if you think about it, It's crazy. Here you have the most powerful man in the world. He's literally worshipped as a god in his own lifetime. Unlimited wealth. He's the head of the most powerful army in the world. He's the head of the most powerful empire that the world has ever known. And every night he goes to his tent or his palace, and he writes in this little book where he like writes little like notes to himself about how he wasn't good enough or how he could have been better, what he should do differently next time. And then not only did he do that, but somehow this document survived over 2,000 years, and we have it, and we can read it now, and it inspired all these really interesting, smart people along the way, and that's what Stoicism as a philosophy is. And, you know, I read that when I was 19 years old. Believe it or not, it was Dr. Drew who turned me on to it. I met him at this conference when I was a kid, and I was like, hey, like, what book should I read? And he was like, you got to read Meditations. You got to read this book by Epictetus, who's another Stoic philosopher. I read them. It totally changed my life. And I based this book on sort of one single thought from that book and then illustrate it with people from history.
Mm-hmm. It's funny when you read Marcus Aurelius, you read any of the Greek Stoics, and for that matter, Socrates and Plato, you realize, man, they wrote this stuff, you know, 3,000 years ago, and it's the responsibility to being an ethical human being, the responsibility to yourself as a human being, it never goes away. It's just as relevant. Those writings are just as relevant with the exponential growth of technology and everything.
Yeah, but human psychology and human biology have not changed, you know? And I mean, that's so much of it.
But
I think,
just even moral, the notion of human nature, the notion of the moral sense, the notion of the ethical sense, that sort of there is a way to live your life. There is a way to deal with adversity. And the thing about the book is, look, there are things in life that are going to happen to you you can't change. And the obstacle is the way, is the idea I got was, it's not a question of trying to control that. It's a question of how you react to what you're given. Totally. Now, this is not a new idea. And one of the things that was funny is I'm 47. How old are you?
27.
Yeah, you're 27. At 27, this is a book. It's impressive, by the way, that you wrote this book at your age. But at 27, this was a book for me. I would have been like, well, yes, all this stuff. At 47, I try to live my life like this way. But one of the things I thought was interesting is that what I liked about the book was you always need a reminder.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It did a very good job of reminding me of stuff that you always have to keep reminding yourself of the fact that, look, this is a situation. I'm not feeling good about it, or I'm scared, or I'm worried. What am I not looking at? What am I not looking at that I have already, right? It just stresses and the obstacles in life blind you to your possibilities.
Your emotions do. I mean, that's the point. That's what the Buddha realized, you know, all those years ago, was the fact that our greatest obstacle is always our own perspective. You know, we look at the world in a certain way, and it's so easy to get emotional and then lose sight of what reality is. And I think that's what's nice about the obstacle is the way. It's not just that you're saying, you know, it's not just to neutralize that perspective, but to flip it on its head, you know, to embrace the idea that rather than the obstacle being a problem, it's an opportunity.
Yeah. And look, I think intuitively we know this, but if you can, what Stoicism is a sort of a framework or a series of reminders. So you actually do that in the situation. It's like, look, you know, something bad happens, chances are 10 years from now, you're not going to be that stressed about it. And you're gonna be like, oh yeah, that was like for the best.
Right.
But why not feel that right now, instead of feeling super shitty right now and upset and angry
right.
or making it way worse in the meantime.
Mm-hmm. Well, what would you say for you is the best way to do that on the spot? Like, what are the questions you ask yourself? Cause you touch on that in the book.
Yeah, so I think the
Which
first...
Which I love that idea, to change, sort of reprogramming your brain to ask the right questions, not the wrong questions in a stressful situation, right?
Yeah, it's really interesting. So Stoicism is sort of connected to cognitive behavioral therapy, which mm-hmm. is one of the sort of, I mean, millions of people get this kind of therapy, but it's the idea that our sort of brains and behaviors run in these patterns. And if we can understand those patterns and then make a distinction between like healthy constructive patterns and destructive patterns, then we can interrupt the destructive ones and then hopefully sort of channel that in a different direction. And so I think it's about like sort of stepping back and like maybe looking at yourself from up here and going like, what am I doing here? Is this the right thing to do? Is this what I actually want to do?
Mm-hmm.
Is what I'm doing here in any way helpful to me? Or am I just, am I reacting emotionally? Am I reacting in a way that, you know, 3 days from now I'm going to say like, well, I would do it differently if I could do it over again.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
sort of what
well,
I'm thinking
well,
about.
Well, one of the things for me is I realize as a comic, I spend as a kid and even as an adult, it's getting less, but I spent years, an inordinate amount of time all the time wishing I were somewhere else, someone else. Usually somebody, probably, at least I have some Samoan in me. I'm at least 220 pounds. I'm proficient in...
But 220 pounds of pure muscle.
Oh, dude, what? Yeah. And not only pure muscle, fast twitch muscle. I mean, I've got a fantasy physique in my life. Like, I want to be a killer Muay Thai guy. I want to be a killer... I want to be a cage fighter, a top-of-the-food-chain cage fighter. I want to be an excellent piano player. I want to be an amazing author. And so much of what I write about as a comic, and so much of... I think the reason I've done well as a comic is it's all about, you know, my heart broke as a kid realizing I wasn't going to be this big, powerful pro athlete. But thank God, because that's all I write about. All I write about is that, what a bitch I am, but how I wish I was something else. The stories I tell about fighting, which are way exaggerated, you know, all that stuff is so using your shortcomings, using whatever the pain is that you grew up with is so crucial. And in fact, is usually where the gold lies.
Yeah, well, and look, I think part of comedy is sort of stepping back and looking at things from a different perspective than everyone else and seeing the absurdity in the situation, the frustration in the situation, just to see it and then be able to articulate what it means and sort of it's to be like, this is what I want to do, this is what I feel, this is why that's ridiculous, and now I'm going to explain it to you, and then hopefully people benefit from that sort of dichotomy.
Right.
Like Louis C.K., I think, If Louis C.K. lived, I don't know, 100 years ago, would he be a philosopher? He probably wouldn't be a stand-up comedian.
You're
you know
right.
what I mean?
He'd probably be a satirist or something like yeah. that. I like using the word satirist, by the way.
For sure.
You use it really well, Brian. That was a great,
much.
Great use of it.
Thanks, man. Yesterday, we had a guest on. How about that long introduction I gave?
That was really amazing.
I was rambling.
You talked
like,
a lot.
I was trying to, like, what? I was trying to...
But Brian, that's because better. You were emotional and you didn't step back from it and reflect on the situation and, you know.
You're probably right, yeah. Marty. Well, you never stop having to remind yourself of
totally.
How to live.
Yeah, and I think...
Our default is to spin out of control because you talk about it in the book. We've evolved to be able to detect danger and either run or fight, and it puts you in this heightened state of emotion. And the fact is that... And you could even say, like, I love the Hurricane Carter example, you know, where he looked at the warden and said, I'm not.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's a great story.
I'm not a prisoner.
Right.
And you will not take my power away.
Yeah.
Because there were certain. Somebody said, a historian asked a group of historians, a famous historian, I can't remember his name, but he was sort of an eminent guy, and all the other historians looked up to him. And he said, when did the civil rights movement begin in this country? And went, well, the march in Birmingham, and they all had different ideas. He said, wrong, wrong, wrong. He said, the civil rights movement began in this country the day the first slave was brought to American soil, the first black man was brought. In other words, there's no such thing as a slave. There's something called a human being who is enslaved,
right.
who is put into bondage, and any human being is always trying to get out of bondage, right?
Yeah.
That idea, and Maya Angelou died today. And Maya Angelou, and I was listening to an expose on it was that's the wrong word, but just sort of an expose.
I'm really excited about the Maya Angelou
expose. She was into drugs.
Yeah,
she was into drugs and had a lot of sex.
Good author's gone bad.
Exactly. She didn't even write that stuff. No, but it was this sort of they were talking about her life, and Maya Angelou was that person who came from poorer than poor. And she had been sexually assaulted and all that stuff, and she was a voluntary mute for a long time. I mean, I think she wrote some crazy, like, 7 autobiographies, starting with the one called I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. And she was a classic example of somebody who said, the way I react to this, I am going to be who I choose to be. She went to Egypt in the 50s and became a journalist. I mean, think about that. As a black woman, she was a singer. She was a dancer. I mean, she was an actress. She did it all.
Right.
And if someone like that can do it, you know what I mean? Like, we don't have any excuses, bro.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like you do not have excuses. I know it's tough, but you know, if that's why looking at examples, and the book is full of them, looking at examples of people that have achieved great things, one of the things you realize is that they weren't really geniuses. They didn't have, and I mean, they were talented, but they didn't necessarily have more than you did. They just decided.
Had a better attitude.
They had a better attitude. Just decided that this is who I'm going to be, and nothing's mm-hmm. going to stop me.
Yeah, there's this line in Frederick Douglass's memoir where he says, like, it's this pivotal scene where he's being beaten, and he's like, you know what, I'm just not going to do this anymore, and he beats the shit out of his overseer.
That's right.
And then he goes, like, he realizes that in that moment, he's still a slave, but he's like, as long as you can't beat me anymore, I'm already half free. And that was sort of this pivotal moment mm-hmm. in his life. And then I forget who observed it, but they were saying, like, how crazy is it that, like, when schools teach Frederick Douglass's memoir, that there's all these, like, words that they have to define for, like, school children. And he's like, what does it mean that an escaped slave who taught himself to read knows bigger words than your average school student?
Absolutely.
And so it's like, not only did everyone before you have more or less the same problems as you, but then they were also enslaved or also facing the Great Depression or also had to fight in World War II
You've got a lot of examples of companies that were started during the Depression, in the biggest depressions Disney.
Right.
Coors. I mean, all these huge companies were started because they, and Rockefeller, you use Rockefeller as an example.
Rockefeller's dad is amazing. Like, if you look, like, Rockefeller did not grow up rich. He grew up,
his dad was a total scumbag.
His dad was a criminal.
Total alcoholic and used to cheat his kids out of money so that they wouldn't be suckers.
Right. I mean, his dad was literally a snake oil salesman. Like, that's what he sold.
Yeah. Jeez. I mean, like, that's the thing. It's so interesting because, I mean, you know, Andrew Carnegie has this great quote that in America it's 3 generations from shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves, right? So, you know, people start off doing construction work and 3 generations later they've made a fortune and lost a fortune and they're back to doing construction work or whatever it is. And, you know, I mean, I think that's so much of it is that first generation goes through so much difficulty. And, you know, they achieve a tremendous amount. And then they get to the second generation and they're like, wow, look at how much I achieved with nothing. Imagine if I gave my kids everything. And they don't understand that it was the sort of resourcefulness that you're talking about in this book that is really the key to success, much more than resources.
Sure. Well, look, when you study history, I think it gives you perspective. So it's like when I think, like my grandfather fought in World War II, and that sounds like awful to me. I can't wrap my head around that happening. But then it's like, I'm sure he was just thinking like, I'm so glad I didn't have to fight in World War I because that would have been way worse.
Yeah, then, yeah, my God. That's hilarious. Actually, World War II as a soldier, better than that trench warfare shit with that mustard gas.
Oh, yeah. Fuck.
And that's way better than fighting in the Civil War.
Yeah.
Like, and then that's probably better than fucking dying in some ship in the British Navy, like in before
scurvy.
That. Yeah, right.
I mean, listen, scurvy is one of the worst things that can happen to a person.
It sucks.
Yeah. never experienced it.
Gums bleed and
your teeth fall. I mean, the reason why is because you need vitamin C to make collagen.
Well, it's vitamin, but you're from England.
Fine.
Keep going.
But anyway, and the point is the collagen is what holds your skin together. So you lose the ability to produce the protein that holds your skin together.
Damn.
So your skin starts falling apart.
It's gotta suck.
And the best part is I was reading somewhere that like we discovered and then forgot the cure to scurvy like several times.
Yeah.
So it's like, just imagine you're just born in one of those gap periods where they're like, they forgot that you're supposed to eat fruit.
Your
teeth fall out.
You think about that stuff. I mean,
there's a great, great book called The Diffusion of Innovations. And the opening of it is basically just the whole history of like curing scurvy because we tend to think that a good idea will succeed on its own merits. And that's not true.
No.
You know, they figured that out. It's a simple intervention. You give somebody a lime, and it takes hundreds of years for it to become standard practice. It's amazing.
So
it's really amazing.
And people just had this understanding of life where it was like, oh yeah, all the men are just their limbs are falling off, their teeth are falling out, they're just withering away and dying. That's the industry.
Yeah.
Like that's what being in the Navy is about.
Right.
Like just take it.
Yeah.
Well, slavery was considered to be, you know, if you look at the abolitionist movement in worldwide movement, slavery was the order of the day. Slavery had always been, think about it, for thousands of years, the way things were. If you were in an unfortunate situation, you were taken as a slave. When you came in and you conquered, when Constantinople was conquered after standing for 1,000 years, the 50,000 of those people that weren't killed were taken as slaves.
Yeah.
You were just, now you're a slave. See you later. Say bye to your kids or whatever, or we're going to kill the men and the women if they're not good looking. You're going to go.
And are not virgins.
Whatever the case. I mean, the brutality of that. And in a relatively short period of time, the abolitionist movement took hold and they actually succeeded. You know?
Well, the value of human life has gone up so much over time.
Right. You know? And that's not to glamorize or to say that we should go back to a time when people had that view. But you just had, like, I was reading this book and they were talking about, like, we only, like, figured out, like, what tornadoes were, like, about 120 years ago or so. Like, we just thought they were this thing that happened and we didn't know what they meant.
Sure,
and whatever, right? So imagine you live in this small town, you're hanging out, it starts raining, and then all of a sudden everything is thrown up into the air, then thrown back in the ground. Like, there's just a giant flat area where your world, you would have thought that you lived in a world where there was this angry God who could just ruin everything if you did anything wrong.
That's right.
And
that'll make you religious right quick.
Sure. It will also
make starts raining. Let's go to church. Hurry up.
Right. It'll also just make you very humble and you won't, you will exist in the present moment and not in this future where everything is awesome and will pan out exactly how you want it to be. And so I think that attitude is not, I mean, it's not ideal, but it's certainly healthier than...
It is healthier in terms of being humble really means that there's something much bigger than you are
exactly.
out there.
Yeah.
And that's a valuable thing, right? I mean, I think because in a sense, it causes you to forget about yourself a little bit more.
Totally.
Actually the word humble originally comes from earth.
Yes, the earth.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing is that it's about being grounded. And the key to you going where you want to go is what you already have. Like, it's figuring out how to turn what you already have into something greater. So if you're not humble, then you don't see the resources that are available at your disposal, and you have no potential to be able to get to that ultimate goal.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the thing. I mean, you know, the obstacle is the way. I mean, it is really, I think it's incredibly timely because of all the things that we're talking about, which is that, you know, the standard of living has gone up so much over the last, you know, 5,000 years for the average person. And it's so easy for us to lose sight of just how much we have and how much more we can do. And that ultimately, no matter what technology we have, the greatest obstacle will always be human psychology.
Yeah, well, but this is the kind of book I wish they had younger kids read too. Like, I want kids to, like, it'd be a good thing to teach. Mm-hmm. Like, because we don't learn. Like, think about school. We go in there and we learn, you know, courses, history mm-hmm. and social studies and stuff. But we never ever give children the scaffolding and the perspective. This book could have been called Perspective too. You know, you need perspective.
But I think the obstacle is the way is a better title.
Well, I do too. I do too. I think Perspective. Whatever. I agree with you. But that's something that's really, really important for kids. Look, kids, life's a kick in the nuts. By the way, thank God. That's a good thing, mm-hmm. not a bad thing. Learn how to use it.
That's right.
It's a question of how you react to something, not, you know. Not...
And those are the people that inspire us, too. Yeah. I mean, you know.
That's got to, like scurvy, that idea still hasn't permeated.
No, it hasn't, but
a lot of people are whiners.
But it hasn't. I mean, that's the amazing thing. This is something that has been known for thousands of years. I mean, you know, the Buddhism is the same thing. You know, mm-hmm. it's all about the fact that, you know, you have a perspective on the world that creates your emotional reality. And then you believe that that emotional reality is the truth, right? Mm-hmm. Maya, illusion, all that stuff.
Yeah.
This is something that is really, and that's why we had Jonathan Haidt on, because that is, now there's so much science to back up the truth of everything that you're saying.
Right.
And it's time that we really embrace that and recognize that fact, because that's how we get to the next stage.
Right. Well, go ahead.
Part of the reason I wrote the book is so I dropped out of college, but my class graduated into the recession. Mm-hmm. And so I saw most of my friends do two things. They were like, well, I'm going to move back home with mom and dad, or I'm going to go back. I'm going to spend another 4 years in school. And then when I leave, it will all magically be better now. Like, the recession will be over. And then finally, like, Google will hire me.
I was going to ask you about this. This is interesting. Yeah.
And so that's sort of, I sort of see my generation as having been taught that it's like, if you do this and this and this, then it's all going to be exactly how you want it to be. And you're gonna get your dream job. You're gonna be mm-hmm. entitled to do this. But that's not how it works. And you know, shit always intervenes. And in this case, it was a global financial meltdown that happened to intervene, and people were totally unprepared for it. And they're like they call one of the names for the millennial generation is this sort of lost generation. It's like the other lost generation fought in World War I. Like, they were the lost generation because of trench warfare. You're telling me that this is the lost generation because Bear Stearns went out of business? Like, that's insane.
Right, right. That perspective is so important, though. Right,
yeah.
Right. I mean, that's... For a guy your age to have had that perspective is pretty, pretty remarkable. I mean, you were able to stand back and see this stuff, right? I mean...
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, and then to execute on it. I mean, it's one thing to see it, but then actually write a book and go all through. And
two books.
You were, you know, Robert Greene, you worked with him for a long time, mm-hmm. I believe.
Why did you go work with Robert?
So I was in college, and I met him through a friend, and he needed a research assistant. So
Robert wrote Mastery, and he wrote The 48 Laws of Power and The 48 Laws of Seduction. And
The 33 Strategies of War.
Yeah.
And then he wrote a book with 50 Cent. So he needed a research assistant, and to me that was like my dream job. Mm-hmm. So I got this sort of trial, and then I dropped out of school like 2 weeks later to sort of make the most.
Where'd you go
to
school?
UC Riverside.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. Cool.
Yeah.
You break the book up into three parts: perception, action, and will. Talk about action, because we've been talking about perception.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the reason I have action come after perception is that I don't want anyone to think that this is like, oh, you just got to look at the glass as though it's like half full. It's not about that. It's about saying, okay, this is what's actually in the glass, and then I'm going to fill it up with what I mm-hmm. do. Like, Stoicism, like Marcus Aurelius is the emperor of Rome. He's not just like, oh, I'm just going to say things are awesome. Like, he has supreme power and responsibility that rests upon him. So, you know, in the action section, I'm talking about what you actually do about obstacles. And I think you know, one, if there's two quick things there, one is that, you know, we sort of wait for everything to be perfect before we start, which sort of goes to the thing we're just talking about. It's like, oh, I'm going to wait for the perfect job market, then I'm going to start my company, or then I'm going to do this. That's not really how it works. And then the other is I see people, it's like they have some obstacle and then they just like throw themselves at it and they don't question whether that's actually the best way to do it. It's like, no one is, when I say the obstacle is the way, I'm not saying like, you know, hurl yourself at a brick wall because it's probably not going anywhere.
Yeah.
How do you find a way to go under it or over it, around it, or whatever? That's the sort of stoic idea of pragmatism and realism and those sort of things.
And I think that's...
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Barbara Enright writes that book, Brightsided, about we got caught up in this whole, like, I'm going to think positively and the secret, and I'm going to manifest this stuff. And she said that kind of positive thinking was actually, you had a lot of CEOs holding these positive thinking rallies and we can no matter what and all that bullshit. And by the way, Obama, that same thing, yes, we can, kind of horseshit.
I prefer si se puede.
Yeah, exactly. But the... The problem is that gets in the way of critical thinking.
Yeah, but see,
you can't be too positive. You got to be able to see what you got to be able to look at, what the obstacle is.
I think that's the interesting thing. Like Martin Seligman, who's really the founder of positive psychology, and you know, has a long, long, long academic career. He's one of the best psychologists out there. But he makes the point that optimism is strongly correlated with being delusional, and pessimism is strongly correlated with realism. Mm. The problem is that you know those you need both.
Yeah.
You need the ability to see things as they are, but then not just simply wallow in things as they are.
Well, that's like the depressed patient. I think it was on Mark Maron. I can't remember. He's a comic or something, and he tried to kill himself. And she said, I love the sound of birds in the morning. And he said, you hear birds, man. I just hear a bunch of creatures fighting for dominance and just squawking at each other and trying to get the food, and the other one doesn't have enough food. And she goes, hey, don't ruin birds for me, man. Don't ruin birds for me. And that's right. You know,
yeah.
Take your fucking realism and stick it up your ass, because that's where I draw the line too. I want to be romanced a little bit.
I want the Apollo program. I want to look at the reality of the fact that the U.S. has no space program in 1961.
Yeah.
And by the end of the decade, we're going to figure out some practical way to get to the moon, because that's awesome. And that's the best of human life.
By the way, that's pretty crazy, right? You guys, I want you on the moon
in less than a decade, right? Yeah. I mean, it's incredible, but that's...
There were probably some obstacles in that.
I would say a couple. Look, you need positive thinking, you need realistic thinking, and then you have to do things.
Yeah.
Like, it's not how you think
you
about the situation
things.
That matters.
Yeah, but that's what's so silly about so much of the arguments that happen about this stuff is people are like, you have the pessimist camp who is like, no, this is reality. You have the optimist camp who is like, if we just believe, then everything will happen.
Right.
And you need the synergy of all three that you're talking about.
Well, I talk to so many people. It's like you have friends and they have some problem. And so you sit down and you're like, well, you could do this or this or this. Have you thought about that? And you have this conversation. And then you talk to them like a month later and you're like, hey, so how's it going with that thing? And they're like, oh, it's the same. And then so my first instinct is like, oh, all the ideas failed? And they're like, no, I just didn't do any of that. Like, and then you're surprised that you're in the same situation. Like, why are you doing the same things over and over again or
I
doing
see it
nothing?
All the time.
And then you're like surprised and hurt and demoralized that you're not going anywhere.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
What was it a surprise to you that you were able to write? Like, Trust Me, I'm Lying. What was that about?
So Trust Me, I'm Lying was sort of an expose of the media system. That was my first book. Then I did an ebook between that one and this one. And then, so for me, writing a book is both a terrible and an awesome process. You sell this idea, and then they're like, well, please turn this in a year, and there's no help. You just have to do it.
You got to solve all those problems.
Yeah. I mean, I was very lucky in that I'd sort of apprenticed under Robert, and he taught me how books worked. So I was able to, I knew what to do. But it's the thing about books is, you know, you wake up every day. Like, a book is a project that you work on every day, but its progress is not measured in days. It's measured in weeks or months, or sometimes, mm-hmm. like, for some people, it's years. And so it can be very demoralizing to wake up and not be to work a full day on something and not be any closer to finishing. And I think that's true with most sort of big endeavors that people want to do, but then can't figure out why they can't do it. It's like, no, you're just supposed to wake up every day and practice, and the practice has to be enough, or the work has to be enough, and then you have to you have to understand that this is contributing towards a larger goal and have that sort of fortitude or strength not to need that day-to-day feedback.
Well, again, it's about managing your perspective. You know what I mean? And that's the thing is that it's so easy when you're, you know, doing the, just chipping away at that wall to feel like it's never going to come down. I'm not making any progress. There's no point in chipping. But if you keep chipping, you will get through.
How long did it take you to write the Straight A Conspiracy?
I mean, a decade. But honestly, I mean, the thing is that it's, you know, because it was, it's stuff that I've been thinking about since I was 16/3 years old.
Wow.
You know, I mean, that's the thing. You have a lot of experiences.
You wrote a great book called The Straight A Conspiracy.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah.
Tell them what it's about.
But I mean, that's the thing is a lot of what you're talking about. I mean, you know, we think there are really three things that people need to know about the brain and that are really missing from school. Automaticity, attention, and emotions. Automaticity, if you do anything often enough, it becomes automatic. And most of what you're saying about cognitive behavioral therapy, or as its friends like to call it, CBT, is that, you know, we develop habits and then those habits run our lives and we just sort of are on autopilot. Attention is how we change those habits. We're able to put our attention on a specific thing that we're doing, understand why it's happening, and then be able to change those behaviors. And then emotions, you know, your perspective ultimately has a perspective to the possibility to blind you. And most people confuse their feelings for facts. And so it's all really about seeing that your feelings, for example, kids say things like, I feel stupid. Right. Well, it's a feeling. It's not a fact that you didn't get the math gene. Like teenagers have not researched neuroscience or done a blood screening or anything like that. They just really feel like they're genetically doomed to fail at math.
Yeah.
And you need to it's very much along the same lines. It's just specifically in an academic context and for teens.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But I mean, I think that's the thing. I think this is really one of the biggest challenges is getting people to understand basically those things, and we need as many people framing the problem and addressing the problem.
Well, that's why, and that your book and book like this is about the art of learning. That's not taught enough. There is an art to learning. There is a mindset one should, you know, adapt when approaching something they want to learn.
Well, it's right? The same thing as being at a traffic light.
Yeah.
Stop, look, listen, cross.
Yeah.
Like it's, you know.
Yeah. But you talk about like taking things minute by minute. My buddy Brennan Schaub, who's fighting Andrei Arlovsky in this next UFC, I'll be cage side rubber banding my underwear into the stands, producing estrogen and screaming for my boyfriend because he is my boyfriend. I'm a straight man, but Brennan Schaub's my boyfriend. And
who's top?
And he's going to be
top,
he's 256'4", so obviously I am. But here's the thing. He talks about the training I watch him, that Spartan training. Dude, that's like minute by minute. Take it minute by minute. You cannot start thinking about that mountain you got to climb. And getting in that ring with Andrei Arlovsky, a killer, you can't think that way. You got to just think minute by minute. And now, guess what? There's a guy in front of me. I'm just going to fight him like anybody else. It's just another day of sparring, right? So you talk about that in the book a little bit.
Yeah, and I think what we do that makes things so much worse is like we extrapolate things, right? So it's like you're fighting with your significant other or whatever. You're not really fighting about that thing. You're fighting about a future where this thing happens all the time, right? And so it's everything is so much more intense than it needs to be. Instead of like, why did you say that? It's like, well, I can't be with someone that's going to talk to me that way. Like, and you make these things so much bigger than they actually need to be. And like, you know, we do that. It's like you feel sick. It's like you know objectively, like in 2 days you're going to be better and you're not going to think about this, but you're just laying there in bed and you're like, I'm never going to get better. This is the worst. I'm going to die. Like, please just make this end.
Right.
And it's like, just wait it out, man.
Wait it out. Well, my wife and I had a great fight this morning. It was fantastic. And, but one of the things that we learned to do, my dentist, when I got married, said, listen, learn how to fight. That's my best advice. Learn how to fight. And we had an awesome, traumatic fight. Don't even know what it was about. The kids, she wanted help with the kids getting ready. I was like, whatever, I'm eating grapes. She was like, you're an a-hole. I was like, you're an a-hole. Oh, you say that to me in front of your kids? I'm like, I'll say whatever I want in front of the kids. Oh, yeah. I mean, it was awesome. I mean, we were like, and under our breath so the kids couldn't hear, like, yeah, I'm going to punch you in the face. Oh, you're going to punch me? Oh, do it, do it. I'll do it. You're lucky you're a girl. I'm saying, you know, like just aggressive stuff. She's like, she's laughing at me going, yeah, good luck. Call me a bitch. It was great. And I was like, we were steaming as we left, and I just step back and I go, what were we even fighting about? I don't know, but that was good. I was like, that was a good dramatic fight. I was like, I called her up. I go, man, you're gonna get it tonight. That's all I gotta say. I'm gonna just, and I text her something funny, and she texts me something back. She goes, you ever give me the finger again, I'll rip it off and stick it up your ass. It was something, but we've learned how to kind of like not to stop things before they get, you know.
Sure.
What are we fighting over?
Right.
What, the fact that I didn't help you with the kids this morning? I mean, let's relax. Let's all relax.
Let me eat my grapes. That's the point. My behavior is totally acceptable, and you should never try
and
change it.
I was washing grapes off for my son. He wanted grapes,
there
and
you
I
go.
Was eating some, too.
That's right. Like a Roman emperor. Like Marcus Aurelius.
I'm a monster.
Yeah.
But man, I wish I'd known that when I was younger. You know, learn how to fight. Don't take it so personally.
Right.
Yeah, but it's, I mean, that's the point. It's one huge lesson. I mean, that's why Buddhism has done as well as it has, because it's one huge lesson that will utterly transform your life. And that's what this is about.
Well, somebody wrote a book, a Zen poet I read a long time ago, said one continuous mistake. It was called Life is One Continuous Mistake.
Mm-hmm.
I always find myself going back in time saying, what would I have done differently? And the only thing I can really come up with, I would have bought a lot of real estate in Venice, but I wouldn't have changed much else. I probably wouldn't have dated as many girls as I did. That was a waste of time.
Brian,
No?
No, come on, Brian.
I had a good time.
That's the point. You know, listen.
I never got herpes, so thank God.
Well, there you go. Yeah. Congratulations.
That's just luck. That's just genetics.
That's just genetics? You're saying you're immune to herpes?
No, nobody is. And everybody I know has it, but I'm somehow. I get them on my lips. Anyway, what? Guys, we're back to the obstacles away. You get cold sores on your mouth. That's even better. That's worse. All
right. So
I'm kidding, guys. I know. Yeah.
Very clean.
Yeah,
very clean. You're very kissable, Brian.
Damn
Don't
it.
Worry.
Can we edit that out? Never mind.
So what's next for you? I mean, are you going to write book after book after book? Or?
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you.
Well, this is 3 books in 3 years, so I'm fucking exhausted.
Yeah.
But, a lot. And but, 27 years old.
Yeah, yeah.
And
I got,
done
I
well.
Mean, that's not all I do. But I'm working on the next one. I'm not working on it. I know what it's going to be. So I'm thinking about it every once in a while.
Nice.
But yeah, paperback of my second book comes out like in a month or so, or a couple months.
Mm-hmm.
This has only been out a month, so.
Well, you talk about Will, part 3.
Yeah.
Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so Will is this, is the sort of the Stoic idea of endurance and, I don't want to say fatalism, but the acceptance of things that we can't change. Like, obviously, there's people in the book that sort of overcame these crazy obstacles that I think most of us would have probably given up if we'd faced. But there are some things that we can't do anything about. And so the Stoics were big on this idea of sort of distinguishing between what we can change and what we can't change. And the will is about how you transform and endure the things that you can't change.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you were talking earlier, it's like, You were born how you were born, and the sooner you come to terms with that and accept it, and work on, you know, sort of improving and strengthening that version of yourself, the happier you're probably going to be.
Yeah, it seems that a lot of us are always trying to change who we are fundamentally. I always feel that way. Like, in other words, there seems to be this idea that, okay, here's what's missing in you. And this is what you have to add. And a lot of times it's actually, this is who you are. It's probably more of a process of deletion.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably, I think it's better to look at things as, this is what you should stop thinking about. Because you're wasting your time. You already
you're
know way more
attention,
than you think.
Yeah. Which is, I mean, that's your most
so
valuable
resource.
So much
of it is that, yeah.
You know?
Stop thinking about, you know, my adult acting
shit
teacher said
matter.
Being a star is easy. It's getting all the crap out of the way. You know, you're constantly ensuring your own failure.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask you how to become the greatest comic of all time since you're into media.
Wait a minute. Aren't you
already?
I am.
Yeah, but how do we get people to know that?
Well, sure.
That's a failure of marketing, Brian. That's not a failure of, you know, your skills. Because,
no, I know.
You know,
I want to do something really...
You're like a Bruce Lee that nobody knows about.
Well, and I keep it that way.
Yeah.
It's just too powerful.
So, I mean, I think that's the interesting thing is... The thing I really enjoyed about the book is it's really a book that you can keep by your bedside. It is the sort of book that you can dip into periodically, which I think there's a real...
I like that it's small, too.
Yeah.
I like that it's actually small. It's like the size of your Kindle.
Yeah. Well, look, the Epictetus is one of the sort of great Stoic philosophers who is a former slave, right? So his famous book is called Enchiridion, which translates, it means like in your hands. Like it, you're mm-hmm. supposed to carry it around. It's not this thing you read one time and then you're like, oh, thanks, that was great, and then you don't read it anymore. So I was definitely trying to make something that, you know, I make it for other people, but also like I had I don't want to say a shitty year, but I went through some shit this year, and then I had to read my own book, which was a very weird experience.
Oh, that's interesting, yeah.
And so like that's sort of the idea. It's supposed to be a series of reminders, not something that you hear once and then it's all easier said than done.
Yeah,
you know. And so sometimes you have to hear it more than one time
right.
for it to really sink in, or you have to hear it, know what you're supposed to do, then do the opposite of that thing, then see the consequences of that,
mm-hmm.
and then finally appreciate.
Right.
The truth of the people that I'm talking about in the book.
Which is really, was Marcus Aurelius' goal in writing Meditations as well, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and I was reading one scholar did like a really good analysis of the book, and he was saying a lot of other philosophers or scholars have criticized it through history as saying it's repetitive. Mm-hmm. And he's like, I think you missed the point. Mm-hmm. He's having to remind himself of the same mm-hmm. thing more than one time because it's really hard.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the idea, is that here you have this guy who's having to remind, it's like, why is he talking about being like mortal and there not being an afterlife so many times? It's probably because everyone was going around telling him that he was a god and that he would live forever and he kind of needed a reminder.
Right. Brian needs to be reminded of that too.
I'm sure.
No, yeah. But when the people tear up my clothes and they want a piece of my clothing for good luck, it's very hard not to let that go to your head.
Do you ever touch lepers and just sort of heal them?
Honestly, I don't have to touch them. I just tell them jokes. It's so weird.
And then their sickness just leaves them.
It's crazy.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
It's
that's
really
a, that's a gift. That's
I don't
a gift.
Know. I just do what I do. Just do what I do.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the thing. And also, I think the other value of, you know, because, I mean, I really enjoyed Meditations. And, you know, I enjoyed this for the same reason. But I think so much of the value is the fact that what you're going to hear on one day is different from what you're going to hear on another
totally.
Day. And that's why having so many ways to say the same sorts of things, that's the real value.
Well, and it's not just days. It's like when I read Meditations when I'm 19 years old, mm-hmm. and then if I reread it tomorrow, it's going to be profoundly different to me because I'm bringing different experiences
right.
to the table, and I have different recollections of the past. And I think the older you get, the easier this stuff is to understand.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is, do you want to wait until it's too late to do anything about it till you really learn some of this stuff?
That's right. And I think that's the other thing too, is that, you know, the more work you do now, the further you'll go.
For sure.
Right.
Well, you have to always, you know, you do have to put it into action. Yeah, the main thing is I always say to people, you really got to talk to yourself and ask yourself what you really want to do.
Right.
And then you have to do it. I don't care how much you talk about boxing. I don't care how much you work on mitts. Until you're in a ring and somebody's hitting you back, you're not going to learn the things you need to learn.
Totally.
Haven't done that, by the way. But I did with Taekwondo. The point is, you know, anything like that. The only way to get in wrestling shape is to wrestle. The only way to, you know,
Become a writer is to write.
All that stuff, man. So you've got to really actually
get in the ring.
And you got to get in the ring, and you got to try to. It's got to be. I'm sorry to bring this up, but tennis. I love tennis. Man, you should see me hit a ball. Oh boy, can I hit? Yeah, with this guy I pay twice a week. He's an open level player, and I hit nice strokes. And then we try to play a game, and I literally can't get a game off.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can look good hitting. You can look good hitting mitts. You can learn how to hit mitts and stuff. And then trying to actually hit somebody, trying to play somebody in a real game,
mm-hmm.
oh, literally 100% different.
Mm-hmm.
100% different. So you'll never hear me tell you that I'm a boxer or a tennis player, because I ain't.
But I think you got to be comfortable being bad, and you have to be comfortable failing. And a lot of people have trouble doing that because they think being bad at something says something about them as a person.
That's right.
So they're so afraid of it. And then, like a lot of the stuff that I talk about in the book, you have to experience, like you have to learn by experience and by exposure, right? And people understand this, but then they don't do it, and then they do something that's really important to them,
mm-hmm.
and then they need those lessons, and they fuck it up and ruin it because they don't have that experience.
Well, that's what I say. You know, I never get mad because I can't beat some open level player or because I'm not a box. I know how long it takes to be good at something.
Right.
I mean, that's the other thing. I mean, if you want to be a good stand up, I'll see you in 10 years at least. And then we'll go from there. You got to figure out what you're trying to say. There's just so much to it.
Right.
So in a lot of ways, everything is that way. I mean, if you want to be good at the guitar, I'll see you in 10 years.
Right.
Yeah. It's like, just...
But that's human biology. I mean, I think that's the whole point is that, you know, we get off into these ideas in our head, and then there's just like that base level reality of how the human brain works, how the human body works.
I was a very good lover immediately.
Yeah. Oh, really? Might
be, yeah. I don't know.
But Brian, is that because you're Italian?
Well, that might be because I'm fake Sicilian or because I'm working with a heavy piece. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's the thing. You are.
We'll put that up on the website.
But do you find when you're training that the most dangerous people are the insecure people who are not okay with 100%, being bad? That's 100%. All the times
you
would
always
I've gotten
get hurt,
hurt
with guys like that. Yeah.
Right, because it's like, look, I'm doing this because it's interesting to me, and I'd like to get good at it. But I'm comfortable in myself, and I know that I'm good at other things.
That's right.
So I'm not freaking out about this.
That's right.
But that's what
100%.
People do.
I that's exactly. Somebody was like, "You want to spar? Let's go." You know, there's this competition. I go, "I'm 47. I don't care about the 21-year-old who's dying to knock my head off." And no, that's maybe later. Yeah, that's exactly right. I so much of that kind of stuff is you're there to enjoy it, not even for the doing. The doing is almost like the actual, like choosing tennis or jiu-jitsu or the guitar or whatever it might be is almost secondary to the things you learn about yourself and the process. It's almost like a doorway. It's a doorway to learning more
to
about...
To know thyself.
To know thyself. Thank you. I didn't think you were going to drop old English on us. Why'd that go away? Thy and thee.
Do you know what that was, right? It's actually very interesting. So thy and thee and ye, all that stuff, that was basically the informal you. That was the equivalent of two. That's why they both begin like two in French, right? Mm-hmm. Or Spanish, and that's why it begins with the T. And so when we say you, that's actually the formal you. The informal you died in English and was replaced by only the formal you.
Hunter's fucking educated.
I thought you said that was going to be very interesting.
Hunter.
Oh, Ryan Holiday.
Yeah.
He did not drop out of Harvard. He did not drop out of Harvard.
Anyway, I thought it was interesting.
It was.
It's like Vesotros or whatever.
That's the plural. But or do in German or anything like that. It's the... Yeah, it's the informal you, which died in England.
When is this thing hitting the shelves? Has it already?
It's already
May 1.
Oh,
yeah.
Great.
Yeah. Great. So,
Well, we're doing our part to sell it, man.
Yeah, well, thank you.
It will be all over the website.
Yep. No, I think this is an important, if you've got kids as well, this is accessible to young teenagers, not kids. But and it's a great reminder for adults, of course. But I just think... and I love that Pressfield, whose books I've read all his books.
Have you had him on the show?
I haven't. We got to get him on.
Yeah, you should. He's amazing.
I like him.
He lives in L.A.
He says, follow these precepts and you will revolutionize your life. Read this book, Stephen Pressfield. That's pretty cool.
He's
from
awesome.
Stephen Pressfield.
Yeah.
Does he live in L.A.?
He does.
I've read all his Turning Pro, War for Art.
The War of Art is one of my favorite books ever.
Yeah.
And then his fiction is just amazing as
well. Legend of Bagger Vance. And he's great.
Gates of Fire.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's about Thermopylae, right?
Yeah.
Now he's we got to get him on.
I would love that.
Yeah, and Pressfield's great, and Pressfield was very helpful. Another guy who wrote, you know, who you read the book and you go, yeah, that's right. Oh, geez, I kind of forgot that. I forgot about that. So I think you're right to have it on your obstacles way. Have it on your
front jacket.
No, in your nightstand and read.
Oh,
read,
when you're
read
yeah
a little,
yeah no,
read
I mean,
a little before
absolutely.
You go to bed, man.
But that's the thing. I mean, these are timeless principles because they apply. And I think that's the thing. We all need those reminders.
Well, that's what I like about the War of Art. It's like you read these books about creativity and that it's all like fun. And he's like, no, man, it's a fucking war.
Yes.
Yeah. It's the worst.
That's
like,
it.
You're your own enemy. And you're if you don't fight this every step of the way,
resistance.
You're never going to do
it. Resistance.
Yeah,
it's totally. Always there. You know? There are people that'll tell you you're not good enough, or they'll just say one thing that can throw you off.
Basically, I mean, that's the point. You will find other things to do than do the work, like text, like, you
know. I will look up tennis, like, on the internet. I want to watch Federer hit things in slow motion. I got to get some stuff done before I could actually sit down to work.
Yeah.
But I think I always tell comics, you know, I don't even look at writing as writing anymore. I'll just start writing anywhere now. I'll write when I'm driving. I'll write in the shower. There's no sacred space for writing for me. I don't think of it that way. I'm always writing.
Do you
That's
sometimes
a mindset.
Write when you're talking to your wife? Like
sometimes she's not in my next special at all. My kids are. I don't know why she just didn't make it.
You know, it's because you respect her too much.
Yeah, sure. My mom, my dad, and my kids are in my next special, but you only have an hour. So what am I going to do?
Yeah,
she's literally not. She doesn't even make a cameo, and I got to change that because I can't have her not in it at all. That'll be a problem.
Right. So.
I would think she would like not being in it.
She is like that. She doesn't like attention and stuff. She's, you know, a real civilian in that sense.
So she's
thank
a lot
God.
Like you in that way, Brian. Oh, you don't really like attention.
Dude, I dated enough actresses, and they were just too much like me. Yeah. I couldn't do it.
I have to tell you, that bit about the fight was good.
Just now?
Yeah, just now. That would be a good way to feature her.
Oh, man. Yeah, it was good. I'll write something. Fights. Fights with your wife.
Yeah.
That'll be in my next special.
Yeah.
Fights with your wife.
Fights with your wife. Fights with your male.
Man-woman stuff, man.
Yeah.
That's the good thing about being a writer, I'm sure, being a comic, is like, even the shitty things, you're like, well, at least it's material, right?
100%. 100%.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, what's great about comedy is you can say anything and everybody has an experience about it. You can talk about anything. My friends know everything about me. That's the one thing I will say. I don't lie. My friends know all my thorns. Who gives a shit?
Right.
Nobody's going to judge you, really. I mean, all of us are always messing up.
Right.
I just try my best to be a better person.
It's like something happens. You're like, the first thing I'm thinking about is like, Is there an article here? Can I write about this? And then it's like, can I write this off of my taxes?
Yeah. That's right. Well, I think that,
fortunately, the IRS does not listen to this show.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you gotta be forgiving of yourself too. Like learning how to control your appetites and learning how to have control of yourself. I'm finally getting a grip of that. I think I like saying that.
Talk to yourself in 10 years.
I know.
Yeah, like Matthew McConaughey.
Yeah, good. Well, he's doing well.
He is doing well.
Yeah.
That was one hell of a speech.
Yeah. I like it. All right. Well, Ryan Holiday, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
This was great.
It's a good time talking about important things.
And you're off to go talk to Google now?
I am.
Yeah.
27 years old, ladies and gentlemen. It's impressive that you're that age and you've written 3 books. Take it easy, bro.
I know.
Brian and I talked to Google sometime.
Now. Jesus.
Have you seen the Google building in Venice?
No.
It's crazy. It's like the front is a giant pair of binoculars.
Oh, yeah. Is that the Google building? That used to be the Heritage Foundation building.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
It's a weird-ass building.
Yeah, I know it. I lived in Venice for 17 years. 18. So you're going down there?
Yep.
What are you going to talk to them about?
I don't know. Some lunch thing.
Cool.
Yeah.
Sounds secretive.
Yeah, I don't know. I just go where they tell me.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, the Google lunch is delicious.
Is it?
Yeah.
I bet. All right, kids, that's me. That's Ryan Holiday, and that's Hunter Motz. And thanks again to Rena Marie for being our wonderful engineer. And
going out with a whisper.
Just going out with a whisper. Just fading. Honestly, there you go. This has been really fun. Once again, a great conversation. And that's what it's about. All right, guys, listen up. All right, bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.